In a world where darkness lurks around every corner, one name stands out among the rest. The Zodiac.
We had a double homicide that took place last night. 16-year-old girl and a 17-year-old boy. The boy was shot right at the side of the car, and the girl apparently tried to run. We have no motive at this time.
His first words were, "I want to report a double murder. And I also killed those kids last year."
Step into the shadows with Foul Play Crime Series, chilling new season. Follow a predator who took the lives of 5 known victims, yet claimed a terrifying 37 across Northern California in the late 1960s. The Zodiac penned taunting, boastful letters and made disturbing phone calls.
"This is the Zodiac speaking."
Craving attention, he unveiled haunting confessions while toying with law enforcement over their failure to catch him.
"The police having a good time with the code."
Complex, intricate codes accompanied some of his letters, ciphers with hidden meaning that would take decades to break.
"I got a very taunting, creepy feeling from the call."
"It felt that the word kill or killing would appear in his code."
Listen to The Zodiac, releasing weekly, right now on Foul Play Crime Series.
The Murder Shelf Book Club contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Listener discretion is advised.
$5,000. $5,000 slice. $10,000 slice. And if I gather enough evidence, they might be prosecuted. If they're prosecuted, it might go to court. If it goes to court, they might be found guilty. If they're found guilty, they might spend 6 months, 2 years in jail, and then they're out, and they need money worse than ever, and they're filled with revenge. I cannot live life like that. I cannot have that chewing on me for the rest of my life. I refuse to live with that level of fear in my life. I refuse. Byron Smith, from Murder on Elm Street by Jeremy L. Luberts. Well, welcome to the Murder Shelf Book Club podcast. I am your host, Jill. This is episode 85, The Motherlode, A Murder on Elm Street, A True Story by Jeremy L. Luberts, Part 2. Let me wish all of you who are celebrating a very happy Easter. I am all about the peeps. And whatever happened to Easter bonnets? All right, so in episode 84, The Deer Stand, we had just uncovered some very disturbing evidence in the controversial Byron Smith case that divided the town of Little Falls, Minnesota, the county, the state, and frankly, the country. Byron Smith shot and killed 2 burglars who'd broken in trying to rob him on Thanksgiving Day, 2012. Killed were 18-year-old Haley Kiefer and her cousin, 17-year-old Nicholas Brady. When police arrived, Smith was forthcoming and cooperative with lead investigator Jeremy L. Luberts, stating he was living in fear since the previous burglary. When they broke in again, Byron used deadly force to protect himself and his property as permitted under Minnesota's defensive dwelling law. However, clues began to appear that Byron had set a trap for the burglars, parking his truck away from the house to give the impression he wasn't home, removing the light bulbs to shroud himself in darkness, unseen by anyone who is coming down the stairs into his basement. So please, if you haven't listened to episode 84, stop and do that right now. You just can't skip ahead on this one. Oh, and before we get too far into episode 85, I am on Podcast Row at CrimeCon Nashville, May 31st to June 2nd, 2024. I cannot wait to see you. Still hemming and hawing on going? Well, you can save 10% on your CrimeCon badge using my code, all lowercase letters and one word, MurderShelf. I can't wait to see you. The true crime event of 2024 is coming fast. Stay tuned for some announcements. So we left our lead investigator, Jeremy Luberts, of the Morrison County Sheriff Department in Minnesota, amazed that Byron Smith had given him another statement on the shooting and killing of the teenagers. He'd also shared his passcode and instructions on how to access the video surveillance footage installed in his home, waiving his right to remain silent again. He had a defense attorney, and most of them issue orders to keep quiet unless I am there. But Byron agreed to talk with Jeremy again, perhaps because Jeremy is non-judgmental and kind. Jeremy filled in the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, known as the BCA, agent Chad Musias on this development. At Smith's house, the search was wrapping up as Jeremy noticed a small handheld digital audio recorder that had dead batteries. Musias also found another one on top of the bookshelf located right above Byron's reading chair. It also had dead batteries. Because it looked like they hadn't been used in a while, Musias hadn't planned on taking them in as evidence. But Jeremy's gut was telling him that this was going to be important, and he insisted on including the recorders, with Musias arguing it was a waste of time. In the end, Jeremy won that argument. See, Jeremy knew that now retired Byron Smith had worked for the State Department installing surveillance equipment in U.S. embassies, so there might be something important recorded that could help their case. Nothing evidentiary was found in Smith's garages, and looking around, Jeremy left the evidence receipt on the table, and locking all the doors, they exited at 3:57 a.m. Arriving home at 4:50 a.m., Jeremy felt the heavy weight of his bulletproof vest. And I can confirm this. I've mentioned it before, but back when I was in Kosovo with the U.S. Army as a civilian, I was at Camp Bonsteel and had to wear a flak vest with a big, heavy porcelain plate in 110 degree heat, so think 43 degrees Celsius, and my helmet, and we set out on a 14-hour patrol, and I will confirm my shoulders ached from the weight. You would not believe how heavy it is. Trying not to wake his sleeping wife, Chrissy, Jeremy peeled his uniform off, duty belt, vest, hanging it up in the closet. Peeking in at his daughter Haley's bedroom, he placed a loving kiss on her forehead. He felt himself giving in to fatigue and emotion, eyes welling up. Someone's little girl, also named Haley, wasn't coming home ever again. Climbing in bed, just as he began to drift off, flashes of Nick and Haley's bodies lying dead on the floor appeared across his mind's eye, and he could smell death vividly. He prayed his mind would shut down. His eyes were so heavy with fatigue, but he was afraid. Would the images come back again? But with God's grace, Jeremy Luberts finally drifted off to sleep. At 8 a.m., his alarm rang, but it couldn't be. It only seemed like he'd slept for 5 minutes. Feeling like a zombie, his smoker's mouth tasted like an old ashtray. Joining Chrissy and Haley, he began filling Chrissy in, sharing little as he really couldn't discuss an active case. Chrissy wasn't feeling well. She was weak, pale, and had bad stomach cramps. Did he have to go into work today? Groaning, Jeremy told her he did, as her pallor flushed red, eyes flashing. Their conversation did not go well. He was supposed to have these days off with the family. Jeremy wanted to stay home with his family, but he had to go in, and the more he explained, the worse it got. Apologizing, he went to get ready, with his wife still grumbling. Haley asked him why Mommy was mad at him, and he explained the best he could. And she pouted, and then decided she was mad at him too. With Jeremy's heart breaking, letting down the two most important people in his life. But he also recognized he was being ganged up on, and he appreciated the way these two stuck together. November 24th, 2012. At the office at 9 a.m., he was an hour early. He made a pot of coffee, and soon the BCA agents arrived to review the case. Around 2 p.m., Jeremy and one of the BCA agents executed the search warrant on Jason Brady's Eclipse hatchback, which had been parked a block away from the Smith House on Elm Street. Jeremy took photos outside and then in. Putting on rubber gloves, he began to probe the interior. In the glove box, there was an application for a driver's license in the name of Haley Kiefer. On the back seat, Nicholas Brady's class schedule was found. This was the vehicle that they had driven to Byron Smith's. Jeremy found a small black Calvin Klein bag and opened it, laughing. It held a black dildo and a string of black anal beads. Now, wondering why the kids would have these sex toys, he figured they were probably stolen from someone, and he was greatly relieved that he had put on gloves. On the back floor of the car, he found six prescription bottles in the name of a local retired male school teacher. Teenager Nick Brady would have zero reasons to use this medication, so he was sure the kids had stolen them as well. Other items that were likely stolen from the teacher were a Louisville Slugger wooden bat with signature, a Kodak digital camera, a hand-cranked flashlight, a hedge clipper with the name Tony written on it, collectible coins and bills, including foreign currency, a red jewelry box which contained jewelry, a $2 bill in a plastic sleeve, and a gold-colored men's Pulsar watch. Each item was photographed and put into evidence bags, which were then placed in the patrol car with appropriate evidence receipts, and one left in the car with a copy of the search warrant. Another warrant was executed on Byron Smith's 1995 Chevy pickup, and again, Jeremy began photographing the truck. This search did not generate any evidence of significance, which wasn't really a surprise given that Byron Smith had said the truck was parked away from his house. Once back at the police station, Jeremy meticulously logged in all of the evidence that had been collected. He took the digital camera, downloaded all the photos, and added them to the case file, securing it all in the evidence locker. Meanwhile, his partner, investigator Jason Worley, spoke to Byron's neighbors, getting a statement from Kathleen Lang. She had lived in her home for over 20 years and was familiar with all the neighbors and their vehicles. Kathleen noted a red car, later proven to be the one Nicholas Brady had driven, parked on Smith Avenue on Friday, November 23rd, which was unusual because the car did not belong to anyone living in that area. Her husband, John Lang, noticed the red car too, and he had heard a single muffled shot around 2 p.m. on Thanksgiving Day. He didn't think much about it, as neighbor Byron Smith usually shoots at beavers. John Lang knew Byron Smith fairly well. They had last spoken the day before Thanksgiving when, knowing that Byron had no family, John had invited him to join them, but Byron declined, saying that he was going out of town. John also spoke with Bill Anderson, the neighbor who had called the police for Byron, kicking off this whole investigation. Bill told John that Byron had been acting weird lately and that everyone knew not to mess with Byron. Bruce Smith, Byron's brother, called and requested to speak with the deputy. Around 6 p.m., Bruce Smith arrived, sitting down with Sergeant Worley and a BCA agent, and he agreed to give them a recorded statement. Bruce told them on Thanksgiving his brother called him. Byron declined to, quote, talk about anything over the phone because it was not a secure situation, but then asked Bruce how soon he could get to his residence, end quote. Bruce was in Pennsylvania, but he said he'd check on flights and he would get there ASAP. Bruce had no idea what was going on, but he knew it was serious. Previously, Brian had spoken with him about his security concerns, the break-ins, and knew he was upgrading his surveillance cameras. Asking if Byron was healthy physically and mentally, Bruce confirmed that he was. However, he did sound distraught on Thursday, like he had no idea what to do. As they spoke, Byron also mentioned that he was robbed a few weeks earlier of about $10,000 worth of stuff. Byron didn't feel safe in his own home. Next up, Jeremy began to tackle the considerable pile of paperwork that beckoned to him. 3 hours later, he had barely put a dent into it, but he was glad to have gotten that much done. Eyes raw, head fuzzy, Jeremy headed home around 11 p.m. He checked in on Haley, who was out like a light, and he found Chrissy dead asleep as well. He shrugged off the 25 pounds of equipment that was his daily uniform, crashing from pure exhaustion. Sunday, November 25th, 2012. Jeremy woke up and he did not have to go to work today. He had the next 24 hours to recoup and enjoy being home with his family. Greeting Haley, he happily told her the good news and received a hug and a kiss on the cheek. Chrissy came into the room, and oh my God, she looked terrible. White as a ghost, she was wobbly on her feet, and she said she had been passing blood in her stool the last few days. Quote, "I think I have a GI bleed," end quote. Well, he said he was taking her to the hospital, and Chrissy did not put up an argument. He and Haley helped her put on her coat, and on returning with her shoes, Chrissy collapsed unconscious. Adrenaline spiked as a horrified Jeremy checked her vitals, and thankfully she was breathing. Grabbing his cell, his hands shaking so hard he could barely hit the 911. Dispatcher Jane Fussy answered as Jeremy said, quote, "Jane, this is Jeremy Luberts. My wife just passed out and I need an ambulance right away." 10 minutes later, he heard the sirens as he held Chrissy repeating, "Hang on, help is coming." He heard Haley sobbing huge tears streaming from her eyes, her little body shaking from worry, and he tried to reassure her, "Don't worry, Haley, Mommy's going to be fine," end quote. He was a rock on the outside, while inside it was pure panic. The ambulance arrived and they quickly moved to get Chrissy to the hospital. As many times as Jeremy had handled medical emergencies, it never, ever prepares you for a medical emergency involving your loved ones. Fighting back tears, he scooped up Haley, trying to soothe her while feeling he wasn't functioning very well himself. 10 blocks later, they walked into the ER, where the doctor and nurse had put an oxygen mask on his wife and an IV in her arm. Chrissy's hemoglobin was very, very low, which is why she had passed out. She must have lost a lot of blood the last couple days. What was causing the blood loss? He didn't know. But St. Gabriel's Hospital wasn't equipped for further testing, so Chrissy was taken to the trauma center at St. Cloud Hospital, about 30 miles or 48 kilometers south of Little Falls. While preparations were being made for transport, Jeremy called his in-laws, then family, filling them in. His brother Jamie and wife Jennifer, who lived next door to Jeremy and Chrissy, had seen the ambulance's flashing lights and wondered what on earth was happening. On the way to St. Cloud Hospital, he and Haley prayed, knowing that God was listening. Heading into the ER in St. Cloud, Jeremy had to speak with the security officer on duty because he was armed and passing through a metal detector was going to go poorly. When he told the security officer he was from Morris County, he asked if he knew anything about the two teenagers that had been killed. Yeah, Jeremy identified himself as the arresting officer, and the other guy said, quote, "I wouldn't want your job," end quote. And Jeremy understood the sentiment. Chrissy was settled into a cubicle, IV in her arm, awake. What had happened? Well, she'd almost given him a heart attack when she passed out. They were at the hospital now. He sounded so serious and dramatic, she started to laugh. The doctor wanted to put a scope down her throat and into her stomach to identify where the bleeding was coming from. Moved finally to a room, it was soon time for the procedure. And wow, I am impressed that they're actually able to do this on the weekend. Wow, doesn't happen around here. Starving, he and Haley headed to the cafeteria to grab some food, with Haley wanting chicken strips and ice cream. Since Christmas was coming, they spoke about what Santa might bring a good girl this year. With 2 hours gone by, Jeremy was getting more worried and antsy when Chrissy was finally wheeled back in. They had found a bleeding ulcer and they were able to stop it. but she needed to stay in the hospital for a couple days to ensure all was healing well and that her hemoglobin was up. Eyes filled with tears, he kissed his wife, snuggling in as Chrissy asked if he was going to stay with her while she was recovering in the hospital. Anytime Chrissy had been in the hospital, Jeremy always stayed with her. But this time he couldn't. He was in the middle of a double murder case. All this paperwork was pending, a suspect was in custody, and more tears flowed as she was upset and had every right to be upset. She said, quote, "So you're telling me your job is more important than your family," end quote. Jeremy's heart sank. He had no words and no answer. He felt awful that he couldn't take care of her when she felt so bad, and now to not be able to help her recover in the hospital made it worse. Damn this job. He feared one day he would lose his family due to situations like this. It takes a very special person to be the spouse or partner of an investigator, but everyone has their breaking point. Even though visiting hours ended at 8 p.m., Jeremy and Haley stayed until 9. Haley had school in the morning, so they needed to get her home, and he promised he would come as soon as he got off work. And she responded, quote, "I won't hold my breath. You'll probably end up working all day and night again. Have a good night and drive safe," end quote. Exchanging kisses, they headed home. Jeremy was not looking forward to sleeping alone without Chrissy. 6 a.m., the cell phone jarred, and Jeremy wanted to smash it with a hammer. He'd had a miserable night's sleep. Around 2 a.m., he had finally drifted off. Hot shower, coffee. He hustled Haley out of bed, helped her dress, had breakfast, and dropped her off at school, and managed to get to work by 7 a.m. At work, he was confronted by the same devastating pile of paperwork he'd left and began dictating his report into the digital recorder, which would be downloaded into the computer for their administrative support staff to type. Now, this is not an easy task, and it takes some getting used to, but with 17 years under his belt, he had this. What he did do was listen to the statements he'd taken before adding them to the report, making sure everything was accurate and detailed. If the information isn't in the police report to a defense attorney, it never happened. Try adding something in later, and the defense attorneys jump all over you asking why it wasn't in the original report. Now you are incompetent and possibly hiding something. 3 hours later, Jeremy finished the one report, reviewed it again before submitting it for processing. This was a big case with heavy criminal charges, so this was stressful. The sheriff and chief deputy were watching him. In addition to the BCA, other deputies, the county attorney's office, and the public, not to mention the families on all sides of this. By Monday morning, the news media had learned of the tragic events and were all over the case. The phone was ringing off the wall. News vans parked up and down Elm Street in front of Byron's driveway. It was not as glorious or as exciting as it appears on TV, and the clock was running. All evidence had to be gathered and processed, paperwork filed from all the scenes within 10 days. So he began tackling this first. Next door was the county attorney's office, so Jeremy swung by to go over some details with Brian Middendorf, the prosecutor. Fortunately, he and Brian had a great working relationship. He was a good guy, always taking it all in, listening carefully, and providing solid advice and guidance. Occasionally, Jeremy would hear other officers complaining about the county attorney's office, normally due to one of two things. Either additional work was needed on the case, or the county dropped the charges due to lack of evidence. Sometimes a plea deal might cause frustration because much less charges are accepted in order to get a conviction. From Jeremy's perspective, a weak case stems from the police investigation, not the prosecution. Shirking one's responsibility and blaming others really speaks more about one's own character. He writes that sometimes officers think that once the case is turned over to the county prosecutor, their job is over. Incorrect. Officers should keep an eye on their cases and see that the proper charges align. If this isn't the case, a good officer will go discuss this with the county attorney. Usually, the disparity can be explained and fixed if necessary. It requires some diligence and communication. Also, if something new develops, an officer should not dismiss it, but instead go investigate it. There's no such thing as too much evidence. And it is not over until the jury and the judge has rendered a verdict. So see, this book is really a full police primer, which I appreciated so much. You really, really need to read this book. I know, there I go again. But I mean it. I pick really good books. You know this. The DA planned to have the criminal complaint drafted by tomorrow, and Byron would be in court at some point that morning. Jeremy then thanked Brian for all the hard work, because it never hurts to share a compliment. Now that is an important lesson for us all. Don't chintz on compliments. With work over, he called the in-laws to see if they could take their granddaughter for the next few days, with them readily agreeing. Dropping Haley at their house, he went home, shed the uniform, and ignored the tempting lure of his cozy bed, his eyes stinging heavily from exhaustion. Instead, Jeremy beat feet to the hospital to see Chrissy, singing Christmas carols in the car on the drive over. He swung by the gift shop, picked up some flowers and a balloon, and swooped in, big smile and warm appreciation greeting him. But Chrissy said he looked tired. Bone weary, stressed out of his mind, he grinned and said he was fine. Like many police officers, Jeremy internalized his fatigue, anger, disgust, well, all of his emotions, actually, because cops do not show weakness, especially to criminals who might try to take advantage. Now here comes Jill launching into my psychological analysis. This defense mechanism, compartmentalization, has a downside. It is actually a mild form of dissociation, disconnecting from reality. And I'm sure you see how that can be problematic. Lopping off your professional life, one fraught with stress, danger, erratic schedules, long hours, can leave a spouse or partner feeling cut off too, unable to access their loved one who is remote and introverted. A wall can build up between oneself and one's loved ones, and it's very frustrating for them. A 2020 study, cuffed together, a study from the International Journal of Police Science and Management on how law enforcement work impacts the officer's spouse by Karen M. Frizzi, tells us that 70% of spouses feel stress and anxiety stemming from their husband or wife's occupation. Jeremy writes that while Chrissy regularly vented about work, home, or life in general, it drove her nuts that he did not share what bugged him and never talked about his workday. And I can understand that. After a day of slogging through the worst of humanity, who wants to come home and repeat it and talk about it? Instead, cops tend to talk to each other because they walk in each other's shoes. They understand the frustrations, the pressures, the expectations, the gore. Jeremy and Chrissy watch some TV together, with Jeremy declining to snuggle up with her in bed. He didn't want anyone to think that they were being inappropriate in a hospital bed. He held himself to a much higher standard because he was in the public eye. All right, so at first I thought about this and I said, good Lord, who cares? Go snuggle with the woman. But I could hear it if someone decided to be a jerk and spread spurious rumors and gossip. You know, seriously, you know those folks are out there among us. People with seriously empty lives who need to spread malicious rumors in order to feel important about themselves. So I actually do get it. While 8 p.m. came and visiting hours were up and exchanging I love yous and kisses, he headed home to get some dinner. And then he crashed, sleeping well that night, although he was still lonely. Tuesday, November 27th, 2012. The usual morning routine kicked in, with Jeremy back in his squad car by 6:30 a.m. He headed over to McDonald's to join his coffee clutch group, which consisted of his brother, uncles, cousins, and some older community members. The topic of conversation? Byron Smith. Jeremy was bombarded with questions, leaving him feeling awkward because he can't talk about an active case. You know, you'd think after 17 years in law enforcement, at least the family would know the drill. But human beings are curious creatures. And Jeremy knew that if he was in their shoes, he would want to know too. But remember how Jeremy was describing that crime scene? Sometimes ignorance is bliss. Escaping the questions, he headed to the office and he flipped on the Christmas lights that decorated his desk. As he dove into the mountain of paperwork, he wondered how Byron Smith's first court appearance would go. In Minnesota, the law requires that a person must be brought before a judge in the county where the alleged crime occurred within 36 hours of arrest. The purpose of this is to explain to the defendant the charges. The court ensures that the person has a copy of the criminal complaint, that bail is set, and other conditions of release established. If the court thinks that a person is dangerous, bail could be denied. If the person is released, then travel restrictions might be imposed, or he could even be placed under supervision. The county DA's criminal complaint was reviewed, approved, signed, and then forwarded to the court administration for the hearing. Jeremy explains that generally, in-custody cases appear in court around 11 a.m., and he headed upstairs to observe the proceeding. The gallery was full of the public and news media, with no cameras permitted. Byron Smith came into the court in the bright orange jumpsuit, with his hands cuffed in front of him, leg shackles around his ankles to prevent escape attempts, which had actually happened in the past. In the Honorable Douglas Anderson's court were defense attorney Stephen Meshesher and the prosecutors Brian Middledorf and Todd Kosovich. The judge confirmed that Byron had reviewed the criminal complaint and charges, explaining his legal rights to him again. The prosecution and defense launched into a bail discussion, possible amounts, and whether Byron should be released on his own recognizance. Judge Anderson set bail at $1 million bond, which requires 10% or $100,000 in cash. Jeremy was relieved it was high for Nick and Haley's families, but also so Chrissy didn't have to worry about Byron Smith coming after them, blaming Jeremy for his arrest. So at this point in the book, we return to Jamie, a Morrison County Sheriff's Office deputy. See, I didn't forget. I told you we would get back to Jamie, who Smith brought up during his first conversation with Jeremy Lubertz. It was Jamie who had taken Byron's previous burglary report. Jamie is Jamie Lubertz, Jeremy Lubertz's identical twin brother, who clearly also shares the calling for helping people by going into law enforcement. Their uncle, Jerry Sosalski, was sheriff of Morrison County when they were kids. Graduating high school at 18, the twins began a two-year law enforcement program at Range Technical College in Hibbing, Minnesota. Rigorous, competitive, the standards for recruits were high. They began as part of 350 students, but on graduation in 1994, only 50 remained. Jeremy and Jamie were hired as corrections officers for the Morris County Sheriff's Office, who teased that they'd hired clones. While Jeremy progressed in a law enforcement career, Jamie did a stint in the Navy, like their grandfather had. After his military service, Jamie returned to Little Falls and joined Jeremy at the sheriff's office. Jeremy felt whole again, having his brother working beside him. They bought houses next door to each other, but their wives weren't really thrilled about that exactly. He doesn't understand why. For the public, it can be confusing having identical twin officers. If someone calls requesting to speak to Deputy Lubertz, the response is, well, which one? And then the next step is to describe the deputy, which doesn't help with identical twins, right? So January 1st, 2010, Jeremy was promoted to Sergeant Investigator and became his brother's boss. Now, if anything regarding discipline arose, another sergeant would handle it, you know, avoiding any conflict of interest. Well, returning from court, Jeremy embarked on a record search to see how many burglary complaints had been filed, and to his surprise, he only found one, stemming from October 27th, 2012, the one Jamie had responded to. One. to me, that doesn't jive with Smith's insisting that he was sick of living in fear and being raided all the time. October 27th was the day that Byron was out shopping in St. Cloud, and someone kicked in his basement door, stealing $10,000 of his property and his guns. The whole house had been gone through, and Jamie found one fingerprint that he lifted with Microseal, which is an epoxy. And once you have a fingerprint cased in Microseal, it is virtually indestructible. Jamie also photographed the suspect's shoe print from the door. Byron had been asked to come in and have comparison fingerprints taken so they could determine if the print belonged to the suspect. Byron told Jamie he thought some of his neighbors could be involved, possibly John Lang or his son, Dylan Lang. At one time, Byron had allowed Dylan and his friends to hold band rehearsals in his garage, but the boys had gotten out of hand with more and more friends showing up, so Byron withdrew his invitation. And these kids were all aware of Byron's house and how secluded it was. A supplemental report was filed on November 16, 2012, indicating Byron had provided serial numbers for the camera that had been stolen, which could be used to help identify it if it were ever found. Byron had also shown Jamie the locations of the surveillance cameras that he had just installed. He told Jamie that this was the second time he was broken into. He hadn't reported the first because he was determined to figure out who did it. Jamie encouraged him to call right away if anything like that happened again, and clearly he had not taken Jamie's advice. Comparing Jamie's photo of the footprint with that from Nicholas Brady's shoes, they appeared to match, direct evidence that Brady had been the one who broke in back in October. A report from November 21, 2012 also caught Jeremy's eye, written by Deputy Rick Madison. A resident living just off Hilton Road reported a suspicious unknown vehicle, a Mitsubishi Eclipse, parked halfway down his driveway. Deputy Madison discovered Nicholas Brady in the car. Nick told them he wasn't driving, Haley Kiefer was, and that they'd run out of gas with Haley going to look for help. Nick was given a ride into Little Falls, while Madison patrolled the area looking for Haley, but wasn't able to locate her. There was another burglary report dated November 25, 2012. A home on Arden Boulevard was broken into, a few blocks away from the Hilton Road address where Nick had been found in the car. Deputy Dave Sherping investigated this. The reporting party was house-sitting for a retired school teacher, the same one whose prescription bottles and property were found in Nick's car. The house on Arden Boulevard had a broken-in patio door, and every room in the house had been gone through. Sounds like a similar MO to me. When the retired teacher returned to assess what had been stolen, he listed 5 medication bottles, 50 to 60 foreign coins, and a gold wristwatch, which matched the items found in Brady's Eclipse. Jeremy asked the school teacher to come in so he could look at the recovered items, with him readily agreeing. But now it was 5 p.m., and Jeremy hurried over to the hospital to check on his wife. To his relief, she looked much better, and her blood tests had come back good. It looked like she'd be able to come home tomorrow. Great news to Jeremy. He wanted to be home with the family for a change, and he wanted to cook a nice homemade meal. Chrissy mentioned that some co-workers had come by to check on her, and they'd all asked her about the shooting, and now she understood why Jeremy couldn't tell her anything. Jeremy nodded, saying, quote, "That's a good thing. Trust me, it's far better for you not to know," end quote. Even so, it was hard. Chrissy reported what they'd said, quote, "They're glad Byron is in jail for killing those kids, and others told me it's wrong that he was arrested. They said the teenagers got what they deserved for breaking into his house," end quote. And this was the essential debate that would rage for years to come, and still tell you the truth. Jeremy hoped his family wouldn't suffer from backlash just because he was doing his job. He pondered that it was funny how some people jump to conclusions without knowing the facts. Oh my God, that is so true. I need to watch myself, and I really try to be patient when some case pops up on the scene and not rush to judgment. We're in the true crime world, and this is so hard, but I advocate showing some restraint while the dust settles. For some, once they make a determination, hell can freeze over before they will shift from it, which is foolish, to be honest. Even at this point in the book, I was really struggling not to pick a side. And we've had access to police reports, statements from Byron, knowing about the previous burglaries. At this point, I think I have a position on this. You've probably picked up on it. But it is rooted in facts and law, not emotion. Wednesday brought a welcome day off with Jeremy sleeping in until 8 a.m. Glancing out the window, some squirrels were playing in the shiny white snow. Around 11 a.m., Chrissy called and she was being released, with Jeremy jumping up to get dressed and happily go retrieve his wife. On the way back, they stopped off at her parents to pick up Haley's belongings. Still feeling weak, Chrissy went to lie down for a bit, and soon it was time to pick up Haley. And he told his daughter he had a surprise for her when they got home. Parking in the driveway, Haley jumped out of the truck and ran inside, joyously shouting, quote, "You're home! I missed you so much," end quote. With Jeremy's mind turning to the other Haley, whose parents would never again have this kind of loving welcome. Little Falls police officer Charles Strack, with other deputies and a few BCA agents, had executed a search warrant. The BCA had analyzed Nick and Haley's cell phone content recovered from the crime scene. Text messages identified other juveniles who were possibly involved in burglarizing Smith's residence and who could be in possession of stolen property. One of the juveniles' addresses was also suspected of selling and consuming methamphetamine. The house had been rented by Matthew Casper, who had a 17-year-old son, the suspect. At Casper's home, officers found drug paraphernalia, drug scales, baggies, spoons, syringes, which all tested positive for meth. Matthew and his son were taken to the sheriff's office to be interviewed about the burglaries. Matthew Casper denied knowing anything, but his teenage son totally spilled his guts, saying the camera that was taken from Byron's had been at his house, but was removed and to where he didn't know. As a result, on Thursday, November 29th, Officer Chuck Strack applied for another search warrant of the Casper residence to look for the stolen camera that his son had said was at his house. Approved, Chuck and some BCA agents and deputies, Jeremy included, arrived at Casper's residence. Chuck told Matthew Casper that he'd lied regarding the stolen property and burglary. Agitated, Matthew said his teenage son said one of the stolen guns had been given to a friend in return for a space heater, but he knew nothing about a camera. They asked to speak to his son, with Matthew giving permission for them to do a follow-up interview. Driving to the high school, Matthew accompanied them as the officer spoke with the teenager, who told them his dad had given the camera to a friend of his, Ray Morris. Chuck turned to Matthew Casper. "Didn't know anything about the camera, huh?" And Matthew insisted his son was lying. Phoning Ray Morris, Ray told them that Matthew Casper had tried to sell him a Nikon camera after the first search warrant was executed, when he knew the police were looking for it. He didn't want it, so Matthew had his kid throw it in the Mississippi River down by the boat landing at Lindbergh State Park. Down at the boat landing, Chuck noticed a floating black plastic bag and fished it out. And lo and behold, it was the Nikon camera. Matthew Casper was arrested for obstructing the legal process, possession of stolen property, and fifth-degree possession of controlled substance. Handcuffed, he was escorted to jail, and somebody's having a really bad day. And of course, you know what I'm going to say. They left a copy of the search warrant and evidence receipts at the house, locked up, and cleared the Casper residence. Jeremy now followed up with Matthew's son, who claimed that a friend of his was now in possession of Smith's stolen gun. Agent Chad Musias interviewed the Casper boy, who admitted that he'd gotten the camera from Nicholas Brady, and he named the friend with the gun. So now Nicholas Brady was again linked to the burglary of Smith's back in October. Updating Sheriff Wetzel, the sheriff knew this kid and his parents so he would personally handle this part of the investigation and try to recover the firearms. Well, good for the boss to be willing to get involved in the case and investigation directly. Jeremy writes that Sheriff Wetzel is a serious boss who is also a practical joker. Once, Jeremy was on the phone and his ear began to burn like it was on fire. And gee, it turns out that somebody had sprayed pepper spray on the headset. Now, later that day, the school teacher arrived. Jeremy retrieved the items from the evidence locker, filling out the paperwork to confirm custody of the evidence once again. The teacher identified the collectible coins, the jewelry, prescription bottles, all stolen from his home. Now, Jeremy kept a straight face as he handed him the Calvin Klein bag with the anal beads and the dildo inside. And the teacher's face flushed red, admitting that, yes, these were his as well. Struggling valiantly to contain his amusement, Jeremy assured him that he didn't judge. What he did in private was his own business. Jeremy just had a job to do, and he appreciated the help. Jeremy had to keep the items for evidence, but he said that they would be returned when the case was over. Oh, he is a true professional. I think I would have died laughing. I almost didn't get through this. Meanwhile, Sheriff Wetzel arrived at the home of the teen who supposedly had the stolen shotgun. The teen claimed that he had no idea the weapon was stolen and that he had traded his friction bicycle for the 12-gauge shotgun like a month ago. Yesterday, when young Casper had told him the gun was stolen, he was upset and he took it to a swampy area at Joe Dot's property and hid it. He was going to ask his mom how to return the gun without getting into trouble. Driving to the swamp, the boy pointed to where he'd left the rifle, now under snow. Wetzel took photographs documenting the scene, and he collected the Remington 12-gauge, which matched the one missing from Byron's home. Once the shotgun was processed into the evidence locker, Sheriff Wetzel placed a call to Smith's attorney, Stephen Meshbesher, and explained that he wanted Byron to positively identify the weapon as his, following up by putting this request in writing. Meshbesher faxed a denial. No cop was authorized to speak with his client at all about the incident. Well, okay. Growling in frustration, Wetzel hated this kind of stuff because they knew the gun was Smith's. They just needed the confirmation. Now, it seems to me that this might actually help the defense because it confirms who, Nicholas Brady, was involved in the earlier burglary. But, you know, what do I know? I'm just a layman. The juvenile was now charged with possession of stolen property. Following up, Morris County Sheriff Deputy Jason McDonald went to speak with the juvenile who had traded the gun for the bike. The teen's mom, Danielle Creasel, initially refused to allow her son speak to the deputy, but when Jason explained that he believed her son was involved in a burglary, she agreed, waiving the right to have an attorney during questioning. For clarity and our edification, Jeremy writes, quote, "Some people think it's against the law for cops to talk with a juvenile without the parent's consent or presence at the interview. That is not true. We don't need parental consent, and we never allow anyone besides cops, social workers, and attorneys to be present in the interview when we are taking statements from a suspect, no matter the age. It is department policy to try to notify parents before the questioning of any juvenile. We also ask for consent from the parents to talk to their child without a lawyer present. If the parents say no and want a lawyer for the child, we will not attempt to get a statement without the lawyer present. The only time we don't notify a parent is if they are a suspect in the case." End quote. I get it. I am not thrilled with it, because kids aren't fully mature to understand the consequences of these matters. I've seen cases go sideways when a juvenile confesses, when kids were just scared to death, tired, and saying whatever so that they could go home, and instead they get booked. I just don't think the police should be allowed to lie to kids because they are immature and too easily manipulated. Just my opinion. Young Kretzel was brought in for the interview, Miranda rights given. He said he had zero involvement in any burglaries or robberies. He had gotten the gun from Nick Brady, who had stolen it from Byron Smith. He confirmed the timeline about the trade and added that an electric heater was also part of the deal. He and Nick were good friends, and they hung out several days a week during the summer. And eventually, he got around to admitting being at Byron Smith's house with Nick, but insisted he had not gone inside. He also said that Nick had stolen a bunch of cash and some war medals from Smith, but he denied any involvement, although he may have seen some of the stolen goods. Interview over, he was returned to his home, and mother got an earful of what her son had been up to. Now, County Attorney Brian Middendorf was brought up to speed on the criminal charges against Casper and Kritzel, and significantly, Jeremy explained that Nick and Haley were involved in Smith's October burglary. Now they had returned, unaware that Byron had set a deadly trap for them. Quote, "The trap wasn't illegal until Smith decided to take revenge rather than seek justice in this matter," end quote. Middendorf agreed, telling Jeremy he called in the Minnesota State Attorney General's office seeking help with the homicide charges. They were more versed in such cases, had more resources, and he hoped they'd take the lead. They also had suggested a third search warrant at Byron's, surprising Jeremy. Examine the electronics, like cell phones, computers, which might lead to evidence that Byron was setting a trap or planning to kill someone. Jeremy got right on it. Having a lot of eyes on a case often ensures that something isn't overlooked. The new search warrant was drafted and signed by Judge Freeburg, and they planned on how to go back to Smith's, where his brother Bruce was staying. They arrived at an empty house and called Bruce, who promptly met them there. The BCA agent seized a laptop, computer tower, a bunch of memory cards, and more. Jeremy thanked Bruce for his cooperation, and they left the evidence receipt and a copy of the warrant on the kitchen table. Friday, November 31st, 2012, trying to get the shotgun identified as Smith's, Jeremy recalled that Byron had said it originally belonged to his father. Well, wouldn't Bruce be able to identify it? With the sheriff agreeing, Bruce came down to the sheriff's office. On seeing the shotgun, he said yes, this was the shotgun his father had given to Byron, and he was pleased that two suspects would be charged for stealing from his brother. Shotgun returned to the evidence locker. Jeremy began another supplemental report. Jamie swung by, with Jeremy filling him in on Chrissy, being so worried that Byron might get out and come after them. Feelings about the case in the town were sharply divided. Emotion was running really high. The people who supported Byron just didn't know the full story. And Jamie shook his head. It wasn't their fault that Byron had killed two people. They were just doing their jobs. By the time they finished talking, they both agreed to keep an eye out for anything suspicious in the neighborhoods and to be alert in public. Jamie's wife, Jennifer, would also keep an eye. Quote, "I then held my fist in front of him and said, 'Wonder Twin Power,' with Jamie touching his fist to mine. 'Activate,'" end quote. Oh my God, they are so freaking adorable. All right, a week later, Sheriff Wetzel came into Jeremy's office with news. The BCA agent, Janice Nelson, had analyzed the electronics, including the two digital recorders with the dead batteries. The one in the bookshelf above the reading chair, it had recorded the entire incident. And Jeremy thought, quote, "Oh, the one with the dead batteries that the BCA wanted nothing to do with, the one I demanded that they take in and analyze," end quote. But he kept this to himself. He wasn't really being a smartass, but he was validating his instinct had been spot on. And did Jeremy listen to his instinct and trust his gut? Yes, he did. 6 hours long, Agent Nelson had condensed the recording down to the critical 29 minutes long evidentiary section, which is legally permissible. This is not tampering with evidence. There were just long, empty, silent sections. Byron Smith's voice is heard, talking like an actor rehearsing lines. Quote, in your left eye. Stop by tomorrow morning. No rush, but as soon as it's convenient. Can you do that? Yeah. Park to the north, 100 feet north of the corner, and walk from the west. I don't have an appointment, but I would like to see one of the lawyers here. End quote. And then came the sound of breaking glass in the distance. So he was saying all of that before Nick and Haley even broke in. Seconds click by, and footsteps were heard coming closer. And there's a pause, then two footsteps coming down the stairs as two shots rang out, followed by a male groan and tumble down the stairs. Then there was another shot and Byron's voice saying, you're dead. Next came the rustling of a tarp, something being dragged, and more rustling getting further away. A short time later, Jeremy heard the metal sliding noises of bullets being loaded into a gun, very close to the recorder, with squeaking as he sat down on the chair. 11 minutes pass. And then there's more footsteps upstairs that grow louder. There's another brief pause, followed by a female loud whisper, Nick, Nick. She briefly waits, and then footsteps begin coming down the stairs once more as two shots ring out with someone falling down the stairs. Then came a click, a gun jamming, failing to fire, and Byron's voice, quote, oh, sorry about that, end quote. As a female voice desperately pleads, quote, oh my God, I'm sorry, end quote. And more shots follow as the female screams. Byron says, quote, you're dying, end quote. When the shooting ends, Byron says, quote, bitch, end quote. Dragging begins again, then the rustling of tarp again, and then a short silence with a final muffled shot. This was rough to listen to, and I do have links so that you can hear this audio recording yourself. It was calculated. It was chilling. But wait, I thought that Byron had said Haley laughed at him when the gun misfired, but she had not. She was frightened, pleading, apologizing. While the recording goes on, Byron is rehearsing again. Quote, I left my house at 11:30. They were both dead by 1. Cute. I'm sure she thought she was a real pro. You're dead. I felt like I was cleaning up a mess. Not like spilled food. Not like vomit. Not even like diarrhea. The worst mess possible. And I was stuck with it. In some tiny little respect, I was doing my civil duty. If the law enforcement system couldn't handle it, I had to do it. I had to do it. They weren't human. I don't see them as human. I see them as vermin. Social mistakes. Social problems. This bitch was going to go through her life destroying things for other people. Thieving, robbing, drug use. It's all fun, cool, exciting, highly profitable, until somebody kills you, end quote. It goes on, Murder Bookies. All right, this is only part of the recording, and it is truly devastating. And I think you should read Jeremy's book to get the whole context. Reading this, I was as stunned as Jeremy was hearing it. Byron's demeanor was vindictive, not scared. Brian Middendorf said that this was a first. He had never had a recording of a murder with the suspect's state of mind before and after. With a new bail hearing scheduled, this new motherload of evidence would support the request for higher bail to keep the suspect in jail for the victim's families as well as the community and law enforcement. Agent Nelson also recovered video footage that extended for 24 hours prior and after the shooting. At 11 a.m., Smith moved his truck. At 11:45, Smith walked through the woods into his backyard, which faces the river instead of approaching from the street. At 12:33 p.m., Nicholas Brady approaches, looks in windows, checking doors. He reaches and turns the video camera to obscure the view. At 12:39, Nicholas Brady walks across the upper deck, and that is the last time he is seen on camera. At 12:50, Haley approaches, checking the doors, and she is never seen on camera again. So December 17, 2012, before Judge Anderson, the new bail hearing was held. County Attorney Brian Middendorf, Assistant Todd Kosovich, Byron Smith, and his attorney, Stephen Meshbesher, attended. Jeremy hung out in the back with tons of media observing. The victims' families were also present. Kosovich told the court, quote, "The state will show that this was an ambush and a murder," end quote. He outlined the evidence and the prosecution's theories. And I'm paraphrasing and condensing this, but it's important to know what the judge heard. After unscrewing the light bulbs, Smith sat in his chair in the darkness, loading his new rifle and his .22 caliber revolver. Outside, cameras showed Nicholas Brady and Haley Kiefer. The audio tape was played. The breaking glass, the footsteps, Smith shooting Brady, rustling sounds, dragging sounds, all done in 18 seconds. 10 minutes later, Kiefer calls out for Nick. Footsteps, gunshots, falling, rifle jamming, Haley moaning. Another shot is heard, and she screams, "Oh my God." Another shot, "Oh God." Screaming, a shot, and more moans. Smith pronounces, "You're dying." Dragging, Haley is heard gasping. 1 minute and 15 seconds later, he calls her a bitch, and Smith fires the shot beneath her chin into her head. Kosovich said Kiefer was shot 3 times in the head. That is not self-defense. 7 minutes had passed from the sound of the breaking window to when Nick came down those stairs. Byron never called the police for help, and he never actually does, if you think about it. In his statement to police, Smith described Kiefer's death. Quote, "She gave out the death twitch. It works the same way with a beaver or deer," end quote. Reading this, all I could think is that the victim's family members were hearing all of this for the first time, and it had to be just horrific. Yes, they were thieves, they were robbing, they were stealing. They aren't saints by any means, and they absolutely deserve to be punished, but they did not deserve a self-imposed death penalty. End of my editorializing for now. Now, defense attorney Meshbecher asked for a lower bail, stating that Smith was a native to Little Falls. He had retired after 16 years with the Department of Homeland Security. He had written a memo to the police about the October 27th burglary and others after his basement door was kicked in and items worth thousands of dollars were stolen. He was a good, concerned citizen. Middendorf told Judge Anderson that Smith, quote, "admitted he had sat with the bodies for 24 hours, end quote. Well, Judge Anderson ruled. He reduced Smith's bail from $1 million down to $500,000, meaning that he needed to put up 10% or $50,000 cash. Smith surrendered his passport and guns, and he couldn't leave the state without the court's permission. Frankly, I was gobsmacked by the judge's reduction of bail. I don't get it. Jeremy was dumbfounded too. Smith's family was working hard to raise the bail, and Jeremy had to go home and tell a stressed out, worried, healing Chrissy that Byron might be able to make bail. And they learned the next morning that he had, and he was released before 10:30 a.m. That Jamie and Jeremy's co-workers were keeping an extra eye on their home did not make Chrissy feel any better. And that is where the story will stop for now. In 2 weeks, episode 86, The Lesser of Two Evils, we will continue the Murder on Elm Street story as Byron Smith goes to trial with the debates about self-defense, homicidal rage, and an outcome that will change lives forever. I am extremely excited about our next book, Levi's Eyes, by Aphrodite Jones. You may recall Aphrodite Jones from her ID TV series, True Crime with Aphrodite Jones, and she is a true crime powerhouse. I thought I was familiar with this story about the murders of Christine and Levi Carlson committed 17 years apart, but I was wrong. How the threads that bind these two murders together are exposed is incredible. Thank you for listening, Murder Bookies. I see you as you hear me. How about some 5-star reviews? All right, share your thoughts with me at jill@murdershelfbookclub.com or on Twitter X or Facebook or Instagram, and you can join Patreon for $4 a month. New spring designs are out on Spreadshop just in time for CrimeCon, and the links are on my blog at www.murdershelfbookclub.com with sources, photographs, show notes, snack recipe, wine pairing. Oh, and I added the bundt cake clip from my big fat Greek wedding. So if you haven't seen it, you can see it. And I just saw this. My big fat Greek wedding part 3 just came out. The Potokalises are back. So always trust your gut and lock your doors and windows. Written and produced by Jill, all rights reserved. Music by Carl Hosanna and lyrics by Otto Harbach.